everybody, to another episode of Mention and Dispatches here with the Armchair Dragoons. Tonight actually is a special episode of Mention and Dispatches because we have Tom back to join us from Hollandspiel. Tom, how are you tonight?
I'm doing all right.
All right. Now that we got some audio working, we're doing okay.
Yes.
Yeah. and then also joining us, Panzer Day himself, Doug, is back to join us to talk Hollandspiel stuff. Doug Allen.
Good evening, everybody. Just fine.
Cool. So listen, when we last spoke in the spring, the plague had only just descended upon the land. And here we are months later, and we can't get rid of the damn plague. It's not like horse and musket development stopped along the way anywhere. And so there were some plans for some different stuff with the Horse and Musket Annual, the next one in the series, a couple of different things that you were working on. Can you give us an update on sort of where the Horse and Musket series stands today, what the next thing that should be showing up on people's tabletops might be?
Yeah, things are still very much in development. There's been a couple of changes, and I would say that overall, yes, the plague and associated other insanity has had a drag on the process a little bit. Some of the slowdown is because of that. Some of the slowdown is because from a broader perspective, Hollandspiel, and Tom can talk to this, but Hollandspiel sort of entered this year with a backlog of games to publish.
Yes.
And unfortunately, because of the fact that we're in the year from hell, I don't think as Hollandspiel has not managed to catch up quite as much as they had hoped. So as a result, we've pushed back a little bit on the dates for the next set of Horse and Musket. Right along with that is Tom and I had some conversations, and Sean and Tom and I had some conversations late spring, early summer, about redoing the rules or tuning, kind of doing a not a revision of the rules, but an edit of the rules. Now that we're several games and several expansions or annuals into it, there's a couple of places in the rules that we have found that could use a little bit more explanation. We're not changing anything. The rules are the rules, but some clarifications. And so I've started through the rule book and doing revisions. Now, I will say that I have been slower on getting that done than I had intended to. Because, as I suspect with everybody, not just in our industry, but in general, it's kind of hard day to day to really give a damn about getting much done because of the year that it is. So I'm nowhere near as productive. And then just from a work perspective, I've been a hell of a lot busier. But the intent is still to get the next volume out, which is about the Age of Revolution, which covers the French and American revolutions and some sort of ancillary conflicts. So we will be getting into the early days, to make Jim happy here, the early days of Napoleonics. Really, you know, it's French Revolutionary. So while Napoleon
sort of leads together.
Yeah. Napoleon is involved in some of the battles, but he is not emperor or even consul yet. He's a general. A number of scenarios from the American Revolution. And then there are a couple of kind of interesting ones. There's one that's set in Corsica.
Okay.
That is a rebellion against, I believe, the French monarchy. Okay. Prior to the French Revolution, and at least one or two in Eastern Europe or Russia, as I recall. So those scenarios are all done. They have been edited. There's just a little bit more to go over there. But I think that we're kind of waiting, number one, for the backlog to clear a little bit. And number two, for really me to get the rule set done.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll say having those battles on kind of the unusual topics, that's really kind of part of the appeal of the series, you know, to a degree, is that it's just you know, it's a big sandbox or toy mm-hmm. box to play around with. And I think that's part of why I want to tighten up the phrasing of the rules and clarify things a bit. Because it's such a big, sprawling toy box, it's very, you can adapt it to your own needs. There are, what, 36 optional rules?
Mm-hmm.
And, the thing about Sean is that that's how he envisioned it to start, was that it was going to be something where can you this core system, and you can adjust it to your taste to play all sorts of different battles from all sorts of different places, you know, during this wide stretch of history. And not all those optional rules always work together. And that's intentional. But we also sometimes, you know, everyone wants to play with all the rules. Everyone wants to play
right.
with 30 different optional rules at once. So I think most of the rules questions we've had have been with regards to the optional rule. And then we've also had rules questions where, and there are complaints that we definitely need to clarify some like timing issues, but the other rules questions we tend to get tend to be people wanting the game to work in a way that it doesn't. Like they know a little bit about the history and the tactics, but not as much as they think they do.
Just enough to be wrong, huh?
Yeah. And I think that's something that we're looking to kind of, to address to a degree as Doug's going through the rule book is to give a little more information about why things are the way they are. Degree that we can with the broad brush approach to it, just okay. to orient people a little bit more.
Yeah, and one of the things I've been kind of thinking about, and Tom, you and I really haven't had a chance to even talk about this yet, but I've noticed in a couple of rule series that are for game series that I play, a couple rules for game series that I play, that what the designer has done or the developer has done is they have interleaved discussions of why a rule is in there from a historical perspective or tactically how it's supposed to play out.
Yes.
Okay. And as I'm looking at redoing the rules, I'm kind of thinking rather than a monolithic article on tactics, which a certain percent of the players are never going to read because it's not the rules.
Yeah.
That we put in, you know, a paragraph or two in opportune spots.
That makes sense.
You know, putting something in around charges. And, you know, what that really means. One of the, I think, not uncommon places that we've gotten some questions has been around the charge. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, we've got a couple people who have just been adamant about trying to use light cavalry to charge formed infantry formations frontally.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a mistake you would only make once.
Well,
and you would figure it out.
But the response we've gotten has been, why didn't this work?
Because it's dumb?
Because it's not a good idea, right? Yeah. I mean, you shouldn't be doing this.
I stuck a fork in a socket. Why did I get shot?
Well, yeah, exactly, right? I mean, hey, I'm going to take my hussars. And this is it's particularly egregious when you're talking about horse and matchlock.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, those are freaking pike formations.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm going to take light cavalry that are carbine armed and run them at speed head on to a wall of pikes and wonder why I lost.
Yeah.
And
long spear trumps horse.
Right. And declare that it's a rules problem. No, it's not a rules problem.
It's exactly the kind of thing we want to nip it in the bud there. But what should be the last pass at the rule book? Because the first pass at the rule book, now, Horse Musket was one of our earliest games. That was number 12. So we had been in business for, 7-8 months at that point. And it was really the biggest one we had done up to that point. It's still one of our biggest games as far as the size of the thing and the number of scenarios and the number of stuff in the box. And, you know, we kept the rules pretty tight and just hear what the rules are. I think if we were to do it over again, I mean, probably would have gone with a longer rule book that would encompass some of this stuff. I think that's what we're looking for here is just be able to orient someone. So someone who might not be familiar with the period or someone who thinks they're familiar with the period, but thinks that, you know, the cavalry should be like panzers and lace. I mean, it's not how it works. So I think that's definitely what we're looking for. And from talking with Mary, she says this is the last time she's going to lay out the rule book. Or some musket. So we have to make sure we get it right. And it's worth getting it as it's worth putting in the time. It's worth the wait, I think. Because then from going forward, we're not going to have as many rules questions. I mean, there'll still be people trying to charge things they shouldn't charge. I mean, it's going to happen. And, you know, I don't know why I just said that, because we have games that have two or three pages of rules, and they're very tight rules, and we still get rules questions. So, but
people still overread it. I'll tell you, though, Tom, to overly parse the statement you just made, Mary said this is the last time she's going to lay out the rule book. That doesn't mean it's the last time the rule books are going to get laid out, though.
Oh, yeah, that is what that means, though.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Because she handles all the rule book layout. She does it much better than I do, so she is her domain. And this is why we try to get rules right the first time and not do living rule, because she doesn't like trying to squeeze things in and then it screws up the layout all down the line. So the layout's pretty tight, usually. So I think we just are able to orient people, give them an understanding, first of all, that it is a sandbox kind of game that they can adapt and adjust, and that, you know, no, these optional rules aren't all going to work together. It's the ones that give you the flavor that you want. You know, if we're able to emphasize that and highlight the historical stuff throughout, I think they'll orient people a lot more and bring more people into the game, which, you know, ultimately is the goal.
And I think there are certain things about the system that to a more traditional war game are confusing at first. The counters, for example, the number that is on the counters is a morale number. It's not a strength point.
Okay.
And, you know, as people look at that, they're thinking strength point, and it's not a measure of combat readiness and capability that we call morale for short. The outcome of that is that a cavalry unit which has a nominal strength of 3 or a nominal morale of 3, see I just did it, a nominal morale of 3 has the same results in combat at a reduced strength of 1 as it does at 3. Well, almost. It loses a die. Okay. But it's not as reduced. It's not reduced by 2/3.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the same is even more true when you're talking about infantry. So I think what happens is people are thinking sort of some of the traditional ways about units, and they expect certain rules to be there. They just expect to engage in certain behavior.
Yeah.
So, you know, they look at infantry that is reduced to a 2 and say, well, you know, that guy's at 50%. I should be able to charge him with light cavalry. Well, that's not true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. To coin an overly clever turn of phrase, I almost feel like we put the musket before the horse here slightly. You know, because we've had these conversations about the horse and musket system in the past, we sort of jumped right in with sort of where are we with all of this. For listeners that aren't as familiar with the system, we probably should have led off with, give us the 30-second thumbnail of the horse and musket system as a whole and the period in which it covers. I know we've talked about this on a previous episode, but without having to make the audience go back and listen to another episode and then come back to this one, just sort of the short version. But then I've got a couple of specific sandbox questions for you guys around that. So, Doug, do you want to tackle that? Tom, you want to tackle it? Just the thumbnail of it's sort of the back of the box blurb that says, here's what you get with the horse and musket system.
Well, as it was pitched to us and as we signed on for it, intended as a 6-volume treatment of the evolution of tactics, technology, doctrine, warfare in you know, land battle from late 1600 through 865. And so each volume is covering battle from part of that period, and we have the base game that goes up to I think through the Wars of Grand Alliance.
Yeah, I guess through the War of Spanish Succession goes up to about 1720.
And each volume after that add special rules to reflect the evolution of that. Now, since then, we've added a prequel volume. We've added Fan Annual. We're talking about another prequel volume. So it's covering a wide period of time. You're basically seeing the evolution of Warfare from game to game. Each game has like 20 scenarios, so we're up to like 100 and something scenarios.
Well, like 130 or 40 scenarios right now.
Yeah. Wow. And we're about halfway. We've only done the first three volumes of the six we signed on to start with. So I think that, I mean, anything else you think would need to be covered there, Doug?
Well, that's it. It's, I mean, Sean's thumbnail explanation, and I think it's really good, is that it's ASL for the horse and musket period.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard that in plenty of places. So the size, what's sort of the time and distance and echelon scale that a player is pushing around on the map? How big are the hexes? How big are the maps?
Well, and that
size
that,
of the units.
Okay, so right,
I know
there
it varies
is,
some.
Yeah, that's all part also of what can confuse people.
Yeah,
it is a sandbox, and that is abstracted. So in one game, a unit might be a battalion. In another game, it might be a brigade. And in another game, it might be the historical equivalent of maybe a division-sized unit, though you really rarely see divisions until much later in the period. Time scale is as fungible and variable as is hex distance, right? I'd say in the smallest scenarios, those hexes are between 75 and 100 meters, and they might be as large as 250 or 300 meters in some of the larger scenarios.
And we have, so there, to piggyback on that a bit, there are three scales of battles in the game. And within each scale, there's some fungibility. But we actually have different combat charts, in some cases, different movement allowances.
And
for
ranges.
Each unit type within each type of battle, whether it's a small battle, regular battle, or a grand battle. Okay. And in fact, we also have the same three charts. We have slightly different charts for each volume of the game, which is one of Mary's favorite parts. She just made a face at me. Yes, yeah.
And a well-deserved one at that.
That's the thing, right? I mean, in terms of Holland Spiel, this sort of counts as a monster game.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I'll be honest, if it was pitched to us today, I'm not sure if we would have signed it. And it's not because we don't love the game. We do. It's just, it is so big compared to everything else we do. At that time, we thought, well, we're a war game company, and we need to do big games, because big games are what sell. So we signed that one. We signed At All Costs, the Tim Taylor game on World War One, which we finally just got out this year. And that that is probably about as, I mean, that's a big game too. Lots of counters, big map, a lot of fiddly little things to figure out. And we probably wouldn't have signed that if it was pitched to us today. I'm glad that we did. I'm glad we got it out. But it's really atypical for us. And Horse and Musket, in a way, is really atypical for us as far as the kind of very small, focused sort of games that we tend to do. And that's one reason why we asked Doug to be the developer, because it takes up so much bandwidth that we don't have for how we normally operate.
It totally makes sense. I wanted to ask the question, like, I knew the answer was it depends, but I wanted to get the question out there in terms of sort of those time and distance and echelon factors, because while the comparison to the ASL of the Gunpowder Era, like, makes perfect sense in that it is a toolkit to allow you to play lots of different battles, I knew as soon as you said that there's going to be some listener thinking, wait, squad level with muskets? What the
right.
hell?
Like, yeah, you know, yeah. It's not a skirmish game.
Exactly.
Though having said that, I have threatened to, independently on my own, mostly as an exercise in proving it can be done, design some company level scenarios.
Did you lose a bet, or are you just trying to win a bet?
Well, there are some there's some very interesting things that happen, particularly during the early part of this period and up through the 7 years war. Well, really, even in through the Revolutionary War, that are raids by relatively small forces that never get covered in any game system, right? No series covers these because they're not big battles, but they're the place where things like light cavalry are actually useful.
Yeah.
And I think you could actually cook up. Now we have a couple of, there are some scenarios that are done representing early colonial North America that are really pretty small.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you didn't have much of a continental army there for a while to do much.
Well, and these are, you know, French and Indian War. These are one scenario in particular frontier I'm thinking engagement. Of is, yeah, it's a French colonial, you know, small settlement getting attacked by natives, things like that.
Yeah. Well, and you know, for the there's no shortage of games on the battles of the American Revolution that we all know and love,
right?
You can find stuff on New York and Saratoga and Trenton and Yorktown and Guilford Courthouse. But there were a non-trivial number of ambushes and raids and retaliatory attacks. And Lord knows there were plenty of attacks on civilians that probably didn't need to happen and would have made for some garish headlines today. But, you know, those are certainly well below those brigade level things that may be sort of the norm elsewhere in the system.
They're less set piece battles. Mm-hmm. They're more fluid, and I think they make for some interesting tactical situations. Now, having said that, like I said, these are things that I've sort of thought about cooking up on my own just to put out there for anybody that's interested in playing. We would be insane to try and include them, I think, in any of the actual games. Just to make the point, Jim has threatened to join us.
Oh.
And is trying to get into...
There he is.
Well, we better stop talking about Mystery Wizard then.
Yeah. So is this the part where we get to joke about the Prussians showing up late for the battle?
It's more than...
Tell that to Wellington. No, I thought I was Doug's and one. I thought, you know, I figured you had Tom, you had Doug, you had all the excellent horse and musket talk anybody could ever want. I didn't know I was invited. Shoot. Hey, everybody.
Hello.
Hey, Tom. No,
and
actually,
with that, I think we're done for the night. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, all right. Everybody peace out. Buy horse and musket. Buy two copies. You should have at least two.
So, you know, Jim, as you're jumping in here, Doug was talking about some of the smaller level engagements that he is he's threatened to try and create for the Horse and Musket series. And I can't tell if Tom's rolling his eyes or trying to reach through the phone and strangle Doug, or if he's over there cheering madly that, yes, this is more content we have. You know, as Doug's going a little off the reservoir, but it's interesting, I think, for the audience in that you're almost getting to hear sort of the Hollenspiel Horse and Musket staff meeting here. Like if we could have dialed Sean in also, we could have just let y'all have a business meeting and just recorded it and called it good.
Well, you know, the beautiful thing about the series is that, it handles the famous battle pretty well. I mean, you have those, but it also does the kind of more obscure stuff. You really can do anything with it. It's very flexible. And I think that's part of the appeal. And a big part of that, too, is, you know, from the start, that's how Sean wanted it to be. And from the start, he wanted, if there was a fan base for it, to do these fan annuals so other people could contribute scenarios and pull obscure battles, you know, out of nowhere. I mean, I the next annual, I actually have a scenario. I forgot the name of it. Been so long.
It's been a while, but yeah.
But it's a battle on a frozen lake, and there are makeshift fortifications made out of ice, and at a certain point they run out of bullets and start using buttons. I mean, that's great. I love that. And it's a tiny little battle. But I've never seen that gamed before.
If I recall correctly, it's the Swedes versus the Danes on a frozen lake. And one of the sides, maybe the Danes, maybe it's the Swedes and the Norwegians. But one side, they're like all militia. Mm-hmm. But they literally built like snow forts.
Yeah.
You know, it's the craziest little thing. And we can do it. We can support it in the series. in the system.
I mean, in a way, and I could be talking on my hat here, so please forgive me if I am. Oh, Mary just nodded and pointed at me. I mean, in a way, I would assume that it's somewhat similar to, say, a miniatures rule set, in that the rule set exists, is broad enough to do a bunch of different things with it. Now, I'm not a minis person the way Doug or Jim is, so they could tell me if I'm full of it there, but I think that's part of the appeal.
I actually consider Horse and Musket a minis rule set.
Sure. Okay, then.
Well, considering the fact that the two times Doug and I have demoed it on Tabletop Simulator, we've done it with minis, I you know.
And I know
to me.
I know for a fact that Johan developed, when he was doing the play testing for Horse and Matchlock, he did it all with 2mm mini.
Okay.
And I've got a bunch of 2mm and 6mm that I'm painting up specifically to use with it. It's a hex based as opposed to a, you know, a base width kind of movement system. But they're mini rules.
Yeah. So I have to ask it. 2mm or even 6mm, can you tell whether or not the uniforms have square buttons?
I'm going to say 6mm you can, 2 you can't.
Okay, just checking.
2mm you can only tell that they have buttons.
There you go.
You know,
and if you don't think there are people painting buttons on their 2mm figs.
No, I absolutely believe it. And somebody arguing that the buttons are the wrong shape, I'm no doubt. The risk of making a dangerous comparison, I'm going to make a dangerous comparison. And so another game in a similar period that folks might be familiar with is GMT's Maneuver. And not that I think they're necessarily trying to replicate the same thing, because Maneuver, I think, is much more of a beer and pretzel sort of game. But one particular aspect of it that I'm wondering how it would compare with Horse and Musket. You know, we've said over and over, Horse and Musket's a bit of a sandbox game. You can create a lot of different kinds of scenarios in there. One of the things, Maneuver out of the box comes with 8 different armies in there and allows you to fight a bunch of different loosely historical battles. Again, representational terrain, similar to what you guys have. Obviously, the gameplay is very different because that one's all card driven. And so that is definitely different. And each army has its own deck of cards that, you know, the Americans are sort of ambush heavy kind of a thing. But the forces in the game are balanced enough with each other that if you wanted to pull some crazy stuff out of your hat and have the Americans face off against the Ottomans, like, go for it. You know, everything's cleanly balanced enough that you can just make up wacky stuff like that. How far off the historical reservation can you get in the Horse and Musket, or going back a little further to Horse and Matchlock? How far into the weird stuff can you get by having the Prussians invade Louisiana or something crazy like that? Do the rules support it? Does the counter mix support it? If somebody got a hair up their butt and wanted to do something weird like that, Doug, where would they end up?
They could. Having said that, there's the period is such, now this is going to start getting less so this way, but when we look at the early part of the early games, Horse and Matchlock, through the first 2-3 volumes of Horse and Musket, there are very few matchups that you could have that didn't occur historically anyway.
Okay.
Because this was a period, right, where everybody was fighting everybody anyway. You know, if you look at the 9 Years' War versus the War of the Grand Alliance or the War of Spanish Succession versus the War of Austrian Succession, the major players in there change sides. In the 9 Years' War, Spain is on the side of the Grand Alliance, and Savoy is on the side of the Grand Alliance, but then when you move to the War of Spanish Succession, the War of the Grand Alliance, the 9 Years' War, you get, the War of Spanish Succession, Spain and Savoy are on the French side now.
Yeah.
Russians intervene at different times. During the War of Austrian Succession, the Prussians are allied with the French. But during the 7 Years' War, the Prussians are allied with the other side and not the French. The French are actually allied with the Austrians now. So everybody kind of fights everybody anyway. So you don't have too many weird scenarios. Certainly you've got scenarios, while you don't have Prussians in Louisiana, you would have various German troops in the Americas.
Yep.
So none of it's really too weird. You know, where it would start getting weird and what the system, I think, doesn't support is if you said, hey, I want to throw Louis XIV's or Louis XV's French up against Frederick's Prussians of the, you know, I'm going to take somebody from the War of Spanish Succession and throw them against 7 Years' War troops. Now you're crossing... We're getting into those different charts and different weapons capabilities.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's where it would get problematic. You could do it, but it'd be cumbersome as hell.
Well, and to an extent, you know, it's not necessarily that anyone needs to do it, but that's sort of the point, right? You know, who's going to get a hair up their butt and say, yeah, let's try this because it'd be fun and see what comes up. And so that's why I wanted to ask the question, because, again, there's no out-of-the-box scenario in maneuver that you know, runs the U.S. against the Ottomans. And then if you get like the distant lands expansion, suddenly the Swedes show up. You know, I mean, you've got all sorts of different stuff floating around in there, that because it's all in one box, you have the capability if you wanted to do it. And I didn't know how well, if at all, horse and musket would support it. And it sounds like you could do it, but there's some work you've got to do to make it work. And so you're really only doing it if you're sort of nuts enough to do it. You've got some extra work.
Yeah, the intent is within a given volume, yeah, you're fine. Across volumes, that's less so, because you've made a jump in time.
Yes, yes.
Now, I'll say that within a given volume, touching on, like, maneuver as a point of reference there, you're absolutely right with maneuver that, you know, all the armies are can pretty much be balanced against each other, because at the end of the day, it's And it's a game I enjoy, maneuver, but it's more of an abstract.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, totally
themed game. And with horse and musket, you know, the armies are not necessarily or even often balanced against each other, and some of the scenarios aren't necessarily balanced. They're presented, you know, within the broad brush approach that the game has, is trying to present historical problem with historical tool.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
As appropriate for the scale and the level of abstraction. So not every battle is going to be a tight, balanced affair. I think one thing that we might want to look at, Doug, with the rule book is maybe suggesting some scenarios to start with, because a lot of people tend to open up the box, start with Vienna, and Vienna is not a great scenario to start with.
No.
it's not going to give you the appeal of the series. And in fact, there was some folks I was talking to online who are like, they just got the game and they're going to bust out Vienna, and I'm like,
don't do that. Don't start with that one. And that's one I never start anybody with, because it's exactly what you're talking about. It's not particularly balanced. It represents the historical situation well, but the historical situation is not one that is a balanced situation. Yeah. We have some other battles that just aren't. One of the ones that won for the last annual is not a balanced scenario. It's a great scenario, but one side, it's not a matter of, are the Dutch going to lose? It's a matter of how long do the Dutch hold on before they lose?
Exactly.
So it's kind of like making a game out of the Alamo, right? The Texans are going to get overrun. Yeah. The question is, how long do they hold out?
Right. And it's not, it's actually a similar situation. It's a very large French attack against a fortified Dutch position that, you know, the Dutch don't have nearly the troops. It was intended as a breakthrough of the line, and it replicates that. And it's a great scenario. I love it. It's one of my absolutely favorite scenarios. But it's not a good place to start, particularly if you're trying to do two-player, because it's not at all balanced.
Yeah.
And what you said, Tom, is exactly a point I was going to make earlier, but we sort of veered away in another direction, is we need probably in the rules to also – or adjacent to the rules, lay out a set of, you know, this is a good progression to start learning yeah. the scenarios.
Yeah, Jim, part of the development discussion you missed in the first part of the podcast here was some explanatory text in the cleanup of the rules to help clarify why some of the rules are in place, and then possibly even some tactical lessons to make sure people don't do dumb stuff, assuming they bother to read said tactical lessons, which we all know is about a 50-50 proposition.
Yeah.
So
your optimism is inspiring.
Yes. Yes. Well, I try to maintain a bit of an optimistic, you know, we all know that I'm just as grumpy as the rest of y'all at this point in my life. So,
but Doug, which Vienna scenario are you talking about? You talking about the Winged Hussars and all that?
It is exactly. It is 1683.
Yeah. So, I mean, see, here's the thing. And I'm going to go all the way back to what Tom said, because I think he has the greatest truth here. What the guys at SPI were doing when they came out with a bunch of these games like Rifle and Saber, Grenadier, why can't I remember? What's the name of the ancient set?
The Prestag set?
Prestag.
Prestag, that's
yeah,
it.
Prestags.
Yeah, when they came out with Prestag, is they said, look, within this ambit of time, these guys fought in certain ways. And we want to give you a toolbox with which you can open that out. And so they did that. That's the heart of every miniatures game that's ever existed. You know, that's exactly what it's about. Now, of course, there's the aesthetic of minis and all that other stuff, which I certainly love. The rule set level, you've got two groups of people. And it's almost like a Rorschach test. You've got the people that want a points-based system so they can play tournaments. And that's your DBAs and your Fields of Glories and your Flames of War. And that's fine. And then you've got the guys that say, give me the parts, give me the pieces, because I love reading about these battles and I want to make them.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we have this fierce passion to play Waterloo, Wagram, Jena, Auerstadt, that's tomorrow. All these other battles. But if you're into the period enough, and if you really dive deeply into them, you read about a battle. I mean, shoot, when Doug and I did our presentation at the Origins War College last year, I posted up a Twitter slide from a guy from an interesting paper on the Civil War that says, because we're so enamored of Gettysburg, Antietam, whatever else, we forget that warfare is made up of so many other little engagements, hundreds upon hundreds of them through the Napoleonic Wars. And I've had the privilege of talking to John Gill, who wrote the seminal book on, in my mind, on the 1809 campaign. And as he was giving me guidance for my trip over there last year, he suddenly just reels off these battlefields, none of which were on my list. You know, I go, wait, where is it? Oh no, this is an amazing engagement. And here's what happened. It's a great little story. And it wasn't Wagram. It wasn't Osprey-Nesling. And so the power of a tool set that not only gives you all the pieces, gives them in a relatively reasonable space, but also has this telescoping scale
mm-hmm.
that, yeah. you know, yeah, you can do a bigger battle, but you can also explore this other thing that, yeah, and to me, that ultimately comes back to one of the principal reasons I war game, which is, oh, I read about this that one time, exactly. and look how it happened on the battlefield.
Exactly.
Oh, how cool is that? And Not that we are pedants, that we expect it to turn out the same way or that we want to be run on a rail, but it feels right. And we go, wow, I bet that's what that was like. That is so great. And that's why something like Horse and Musket is such a cool.
And that is, I mean, Jim just made my point. He didn't hear my earlier discussion. He came in right at the end of it about these small scenarios I've been talking about making. And it's yep. exactly those, right? It's to cover exactly those. I've got this absolute burning desire to do a scenario that is the Swedish versus Imperial Army engaging at the river crossing the day before Lützen.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a big cavalry fight
yeah.
there.
Yeah, there is.
As the Swedes try and get across the river, and I've never seen it depicted anywhere. Nobody's ever done it. Because it's one of those, you know, oh, this happened before the battle we're really interested in.
So it's just assumed to have happened the way it did historically.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do have to say, I can't be the only one out here who is sort of mouth agape at the idea that there were Napoleonic battles that, you know, Jim hadn't heard of. I can't be the only person who's wondering what plane of reality we have now shifted into, in which there was a Napoleonic battle in which Jim didn't already know about. That sort of astounds me a little.
Yeah, that is why getting to know guys like John Gill and Michael Hopper, who does a lot of the Shaco 2 scenario stuff, is such a privilege and a joy. It's because they know a crap ton more than you do. And they've dedicated themselves to it in a scholarly and academic way, but they never lose the joy of it. You know, they never lose the joy. Right. I mean, I took a picture of the church, and I got it framed up at the church at Unterleichling, where at the Battle of Egmuhl, where they've taken some of the cannonballs they found, shaped them into a cross, and put them over the door of one of the back doors of the church. And I got that framed and I sent it to John, and he was just, you know, effusive in how pleased he was to get it and how really cool it was and how he hadn't seen it. And for a guy that has, you know, who has forgotten more about the 1809 campaign than I know, to still find some excitement and some, that's really, really neat. So, you know, and this opens doors to that, you know, when you can then learn that, know that, and then spool it out onto your tabletop and push some pieces around in a manageable way. Sure. You know, I can build something bigger, but in some ways that's silly when you're talking about something that's of the scale and scope we're discussing. I will also say that we have seen a remarkable growth in skirmish level war games. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean man to man. I mean big skirmishes. Mm-hmm. Starting out with things like A Song of Drums and Shackos by Ganesha, but going up and through things like the Blue Book series by Osprey that is great, that's got a series from Dragon Rampant up and through, I know a game Doug likes, The Pikeman's Lament, and mm-hmm. of course Two Fat Lardies from Two Fat Lardies Sharp Practice. There's this desire to play out these sharp little skirmishes, right. Raids, contacts previous to the battle, where in a traditional history, it might only be snapped over to say, oh yes, there was a little fight before Lutzen. Well, but in the Pikeman's Lament, or in Let It Be Said, Horse and Musket, you say, really? There was? Well, what was the terrain like? What were the troops like? Who was it? Who was leading? What were the, you know, and explore all those things. And that's really cool.
Yeah. And that's exactly how I use Horse and Musket, right? I mean, there's a great book that I picked up probably 2 years ago called Marlborough's Other Army.
Oh, yes.
And it is about the First Peninsular War.
Boy, guys get mad when you say stuff like that.
I know, but it is the First Peninsular War. Yep. Fought during the War of Spanish Succession in fact on some of the exact same battlefields that Wellington fought on during the Napoleonic Wars. Well, you know, I can read this book, which happens to have really great orders of battle and maps, and I can get out Horse and Musket. And I can literally just set the thing up and play it.
Yep. We still haven't gotten over to Tom to ask some questions, more general Hollenspiel stuff, which is fine. Like, the point of this was to talk some Horse and Musket. Quite frankly, like, there's a handful more questions I would love to be able to sneak in here on Horse and Musket. You know, you talk about going the different volumes, one's up through the Napoleonic Wars. It ends roughly around American Civil War. What happens in there with sort of the frontier Indian campaigns between the Civil War, or between the Revolution and the Civil War? What happens with the War of Texas Independence and the Mexican-American War? Like, there's plenty of other actions that sort of fit within that time span. I want to give Tom a chance to talk a little bit of Hollenspiel in general with us, before we run out of time tonight. So sounds like we may have to have yet another discussion of Horse and Musket down the line, which I don't think is going to break anybody's heart, right, to have to get together and talk about one of your favorite periods of warfare. Tom, real quick, the next couple of things that we're going to start to see rolling off the assembly line for Hollenspiel, I have District Commander Kandahar sitting on the table. It's By the time this podcast posts, people will have seen it in our monthly Unboxing Day series. But what's next? What are the next couple of things we're going to see showing up from Hollenspiel?
Okay, so we have three more box games coming out before the year.
Okay.
One of those is a solitaire game, a Rally and Restorer of the World. That is the third game in kind of semi-series I have with Agricola, Master of Britain, and Charlemagne, Master of Europe. So you're a Rally and you're reconquering the Roman Empire. It's a difficult solo game. This is of my design back in 2018, and we've just kind of been waiting to release it while we get through our backlog. So we're now releasing it in like 2 days. So by the time the podcast comes out, that'll be out.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that does well. You know, solo games, even before the pandemic, they sell very well. Like, I was actually surprised when we did our first one, which was that Agricola game, how well it sold, how much better it sold than any war game I had done previously. And like, oh, well, people must like these solo games then. I should do more of these.
Jim's busy clutching his pearls about solo war
games. I was 6 inches from booing, but I want Tom to have success.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've done three. So I've done 60-odd games as a designer so far, and jeez, like three of them have been solo games. So most of them are two-player games.
Yeah.
The next three games are all mine. We've just been putting stuff off while we get other stuff out the door. So the next one is going to be a game called The Vote. It's coming out on Voting Day. It is about the suffrage movement. Hopefully that will do well. Then I have a train game coming out at the end of November. The train games sell much better than the war game, so I'm required to do train games.
Does it have any X's in the title?
No, it doesn't.
Then we're going to be fine.
I like those games fine. They're a bit long for me. This one takes an hour, you know.
Tom, I got to ask, are you ever going to get with the PBS folks and do a licensed dinosaur train game?
So I don't know if we'd be able to afford the license for Dinosaur Train, but Mary and I are both fans of dinosaurs. End of Dinosaur Train, like my favorite dinosaur from Dinosaur Train, is probably Don. He's a fun pteranodon. But there will be a Dinosaur Train game called Dinosaur Gage. Mary told me I had to make that, so that's probably year after next, I think.
You know, okay.
Have time, we're going to do it together, so that'll be a co-design. So that train game Dual Gauge will be out concurrent with the Holland Days sale, so that'll be our end of year sale game. And during the Holland Days sale, everything is $5 off, and you get an extra 10% off if you spend however much. And you buy at least two games, and you get a free game. And this year's free game is Reign of Witches. It's about the Quasi War.
Okay.
But viewed through the point of view of factional conflict within the Federalist Party. So one player is Adams and one is Hamilton.
Yep. Spectacular.
All right.
Hey, Tom, just a personal note. How soon before I can have I don't know why I didn't just buy some, because I wanted it this badly. I need the Toledo War. How soon before I can get it?
So we don't have any copies of it left. That was last year's holiday sale game.
But I feel like, do you have the print and play thing going on?
The print and play thing, yeah. That's been up for a bit.
I'm just not paying attention.
You know, I'll tell you what, Jim. I'll be doing another card order in November in anticipation of the sale from the card printer. I can get a copy of Toledo War printed and send it to you with an.
Oh yeah.
You know what? I appreciate the heck out of your show, your Saturday Night Fight.
Oh, thanks.
I don't get to watch them all the time. I don't get to watch them live most, but especially the ones with the old SBI games, because, you know, that's before my time. When I was born,
you're old, SBI, Jim. Jim, you're old.
I just had our guest tell me he has designed 60 games, and then he tells me, that game you cherished and saved your lunch money for, before my time. So, oh, Christ.
I was born, like, I want to say 3 weeks after SBI went out of business.
Well, it was an omen.
You see, here's the problem with having somebody like Tom on the podcast. See, now I get to be one of the old guys, and I don't like being one of the old guys anymore. I've spent 20 years around other wargamers being the kid brother in the room. And as much as we complain about there's no other younger wargamers coming up, and sometimes I was the poster child for that, right? Because I've been the kid brother in the room for 15 years. Tom shows up, we get somebody younger in the crowd. Now I get to feel old. So that sucks.
Fascinating stuff. And I also like the kind of historical commentary you and Doug will do on the battles and whatnot. It reminds me of, Mary, what was that show we saw? There was a show,
the Battlefield show.
Where it was miniatures war gamers, and it was like a BBC thing.
Oh,
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, oh, Tom, my heart, you made me so happy. That is hosted by Edward Woodward.
Edward Woodward.
Less than the freaking Equalizer. It's called Battlegrounds, and it was, as far as I can tell, I've never found a pristine DVD. I've offered the BBC real money for a pristine DVD, but it is all my beloved classic minis gamers that they somehow said, well, I don't know, somehow, of course they did it. We're all exhibitionists. Hey, you want to play your figures on TV? And one of them features Dr. Patty Griffith, which is very special to me because he's kind of one of my heroes. And the idea that I might even be close compared to that. Yeah, I've thought about ways of taking Saturday Night Fights and making it more like that show, because then I get to be Edward Woodward and doing that golf commentary.
Yeah.
Doug is moving his Imperial Guard. That's probably serious.
Well, you know, Jim, we talked about this. I think it was back during the second episode of the season. We were talking about tabletop simulator stuff. We were talking about the idea of, you know, what it would take to actually make more of a show out of sight. Because right now, Saturday Night Fights is not too dissimilar from what we had in mind when we first put the podcast together, right? Which was, you know, a bunch of war gamers sitting around talking war games, hit record on the tape recorder, and let's just have a conversation. That's obviously a little different tonight because we had Tom here as a publisher and wanted to talk about some specific things, you know, within his product line and within the catalog there. But many of our other discussions, the World War One, when the Cold War, when, you know, all these different ones that we do, we just sort of, what if we had some war gamers sit around and just turn on a tape recorder? That's kind of what you guys are doing on Saturday Night Fights. This was sort of a bunch of guys sitting around a table playing, and the audience is invited to sort of sit around the table with you and watch the game in progress. But it's you guys talking to each other for the play of the game. It's not the TV show with the audience in mind.
Right.
No, that's sort of what we had talked about. I want to say it was the second episode of the season when you know, you and me and Mike O were on together talking about tabletop simulator and distributed gaming and what would it take to make more of a show, kind of like your Battlegrounds thing. Our good buddy Tolstoy in the forums, where he does the omnibus wrap-ups of all of the different podcast episodes. It's awesome. If you guys haven't seen those before, audience, go check them out. He gives you all the links to everything we talk about in the episode. It's fantastic. He dug up one of the Battlegrounds shows on YouTube and like linked it in there so you can go watch one of those episodes. So audience, if you're curious what we're talking about, you can find one of them there. Tom, I've leaned on Jim to do that some. I think that's just more effort than he really wants to put into it. Yeah. Well, he'd rather play the games.
I think the line that I came up with Tom, I was talking to Doug about it one time, is that, you know, I could probably do better if I edited these. Because we actually, you know, last weekend was so fabulous. And one of the reasons was Giorgio, who's done so many minis for us. This guy's in Madrid. Okay. He's Italian, but he's from Madrid. And he came over to play because he wanted to defend the honor of the Italian Navy. That's why, that is why I war game. I really don't need much else than that. A guy who just was raised on stories of when the fleet might have sailed and done bravely and wanted to defend their honor. But all the way back to my point, I actually have a good friend. He's one of the council members here in Wisconsin, who is a deep student of Native American history and of that period of American history and its consequences. And we have had long, long discussions about the Toledo War and the fact that, and when we talk about, you know, how Horse and Musket is great because it allows us to study, I love the fact that because of distributed publishing, because of print and play, because of the model you've chosen, that there gets to be a game about the Toledo War, even if it's a small one, because, you know, the odds of that in the glory days of SPI, and God bless SPI always, and may it rest in peace. Even then, we weren't getting the Toledo War.
No.
Well, we are now. No. And that's really cool.
Well, I mean, and that's really part of the beauty of our model, is that it lets us do things on more obscure topics, and still, you know, do well with it. Like the first game we have coming out next year is a game from John Gurkowski called Empire at Sunrise, and that is World War One in the Pacific. It's Japan versus Germany in the Pacific in World War One, and
I don't lots see of cool a lot of ship counters.
Yes, because I made the mistake because I have this Wacom tablet. It's me draw stuff now. I do illustrations for our counters now, and I was like, well, I can do a little ship silhouette, and I'll just do a different silhouette for each class of ship. Well, you know, we have like 30-40 ships all together, and they can't be too many classes of ships, can there? I had to do like 36 different illustrations because every ship is a different class.
Yeah.
And I really regretted that. But in retrospect. But you know, I got through it and they look nice and you know, it's gonna do well for the game. So
as a callback to a previous podcast episode, I have to ask, are you going to include the action in San Francisco Bay of the Anglo-Japanese force that had attempted to bottle up one of the Imperial German cruisers in San Francisco Bay?
I believe that's in there. I'll need a double check with the.
Holy crap! That's awesome.
In a while, but
my head is unfreezing because okay, I was so amused by your story. What's the scale of this game?
The game has three scales, which is really cool. At the biggest scale, you have the entire Pacific Ocean from Asia to the Americas, and you know the big it's a big square grid thing, and they're like, I don't know, 5,000 miles per square or something, and then within two or three of those squares, you transport yourself to a hex grid map, and in one hex, you transfer yourself to a mini map. So there are three different scales with different movement rates per depending on the map. So you're fluidly moving between the three different scales depending on which map the units are situated on. The little mini map is basically used for the land combat portion. Almost all the rest of it really is naval combat, interception, commerce raiding, all that stuff.
Okay.
In
Vitz Gorkowski on World War One. How can you not be in?
Yeah.
Right. The existence of Hollandspiel, I think I've said this before, but what Tom and Mary have created is one of the true counter arguments, in my opinion, to the people that come out and go, wargaming is dying. No, we're getting stuff that we would have never gotten in the glory days of Avalon Hill and SPI, because companies like Hollandspiel can exist today that you couldn't have done 20 years ago.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Production technology has changed such that you know, and Tom, I don't think we're giving away any state secrets. I think you've admitted it plenty of times elsewhere. 20, 25 years ago, the production technology did not exist that would allow your company to be viable today.
That is absolutely correct. Maybe 10 years ago. It really lets us make games and lets us make a lot of games and make games that are in different topics. I can't give you a list of every game we have coming out next year because this thing will be like another hour longer. You know?
Yeah.
But, you know, we have a lot of stuff in the pipeline and we're able to be that productive and have that quick turnaround time because of the model, you know, which we wouldn't have if we were trying to mass print, and we wouldn't be able to do it on the subjects that we do. Like something like Supply Lines of the American Revolution, which is one of our most popular titles. I mean,
yeah.
I think that would have been a bomb with like a mass printing, you know, a traditional print. And you know, we pitched it to publishers, and they're like, no one's going to want this. And a lot of people do want it.
Oh, yeah.
Au contraire.
But maybe not the number of people make a traditional print unfeasible.
I can't imagine. And I've said this to Doug. I think we said this while we were futzing about with it at Origin. I can't imagine what the elevator pitch for that game is. Yeah. You're going to be a 1774 Logie. Hey, really?
And you're going to like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh. Oh, sign me up. And I will tell you something. And this is something that I feel very, very strongly. I told you, I've expressed my love of Patty Griffith, my respect for his work. I very much regret he didn't live to see this generation come.
Yeah.
He was its father in so many ways, of saying, you know, he was the first guy that ever wrote the words, "I regret the fetishization of the miniature."
Yeah.
You know, I love it. I will take second to none with respect to art, but we became distracted and he wanted wargaming to go in different ways. So, you know, I had the privilege a couple weeks ago of hosting a game for the Georgetown Wargame Club through Professor Sebastian Bay. I played one of his games with a very specific reason in mind. And I feel that way too about Hollenspiel, that there is this thing that I wish Patty could have seen to say, yeah, you know what? We did think about war games, about different topics. And yeah, some of his stuff was silly. He's like, why don't you do the Charge of the Light Brigade while sitting on a sawhorse while people yell at you to the side, you know? he thought about that, but he also thought, I just think he would have...
I think of plenty of reasons why not.
Well, Patty couldn't have. So many of the games that Hollenspiel has come out with would have been where he went, that's what I was talking. Yeah. That's where I was hoping we would go and hope we continue to go. And yeah, is everything going to succeed? No, it is not. But our failures will be spectacular.
Yeah.
That's very kind. Thank you. Really.
We are going to later in this season have a serious and concerted discussion around the idea of what's happening with wargaming as we're looking toward the future. And you know, Doug had sort of casually dropped it in talking about Hollenspiel here, but it's something that's come up in some discussions in our forums. We've alluded to it on some previous podcasts. The guys over Little Wars TV have done some articles about it and some videos about it. Again, primarily focused on the minis wargaming world, but I think some of their concerns are generalizable to wargaming as a whole. But there are definitely some conversations that we need to have that I suspect will turn into a full podcast episode on which Jim will have to stack multiple soapboxes to fully encapsulate everything he's going to want to say there. But for tonight...
I may just wind Doug up and step aside, but you go ahead.
That is an option. If we do that, we need a two-part episode. Maybe three. And that's just for Doug. That's not for the rest of
us. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, yeah.
You know, we don't want to overstay the welcome with our gracious guests here. And so definitely want to say thank you, guys. And Tom, we're definitely going to come back around to you after the new year and let you take that full episode to tell us everything that's coming from Hollenspiel down the line. But for tonight, Tom, thank you very much sure. for joining us, and thank Mary for letting you join us. And so we appreciate you being here.
All right. Thanks, guys.
And Doug, thank you for giving us the guided tour of Horse and Musket again there. I know we just checked in not too many months ago, but it's always great to hear how the series is progressing from the guy who's progressing. So thank you.
Well, I just implement what Sean designs and Tom and Mary want to publish. So I'm kind of the least member of the team, but it's a pleasure to be involved with something that so closely aligns with the things I'm interested in.
Yeah, well, but somebody's got to actually count all of the counters in Vastel and make sure that there's that many in the physical box.
And that's what I do. That's exactly my job.
While simultaneously ensuring that there are dragoons shoved into as many scenarios as possible just because they're dragoons.
Exactly.
Yes. And speaking of dragoons riding to the battle late, Jim, thank you. Appreciate you arriving here for us.
Happy to be here.
Showing up just in time for us to say goodbye. No, I'm kidding. But thank you for being able to join us tonight also. We appreciate your insight. And we are definitely going to have that call later where we talk about sort of the future of wargaming and what's happened to wargaming as it's evolved. So, audience, thank you very much for indulging us in these conversations around Horse and Musket and Hollenspiel and that era of warfare and some game design philosophy on top of it all. Appreciate everybody listening, and we'll see you next week on our next episode. So thank you, everyone.